Hallo. Beim Thema Meinungsfreiheit und der Bedrohung derselben denken viele von uns sofort an Zensurmechanismen von Regierungen und Diktaturen. Unser nächster Redner wird zeigen, dass die nicht das einzige Problem sind, sondern dass Probleme auch von Seiten der Infrastruktur des Netzes herkommen können. Er ist Professor an der Columbia Law School, schreibt für das großartige Slate Magazine und ist Chairman der Medienreformorganisation Free Press. Bitte begrüßt mit mir Tim Wu.
Dankeschön. Einen schönen guten Tag euch allen. Ich bin Tim Wu. Ich bin Professor an der Columbia Universität in New York. Ich hoffe, euch allen geht es sehr gut. Ich bin sehr froh, dass ich nach Berlin kommen durfte. Berlin ist wieder ein Symbol für kreative Freiheit geworden. Berlin ist eine weltweit wichtige Quelle für Ideen, Kunst und Kultur. New York City denkt dasselbe von sich selbst, aber wir liegen in vielen Berichten hinter Berlin zurück. Heute werde ich über Netzneutralität und Meinungsfreiheit sprechen. Mein Hauptpunkt ist einfach. In unserer Zeit ist, in Westen zumindest, Privatzensur wichtiger geworden als staatlich. In den Vereinigten Staaten ist das schon lange der Fall. Aber mit dem Wachsen privater Macht ist das auch in anderen Teilen der Welt eingetreten. Das heißt, dass die Regeln für die größeren Unternehmen im Kommunikationsbereich wie Netzneutralität auch Regeln über die Meinungsfreiheit sind. Ihr werdet sehen, dass mein eigentliches Thema etwas anderes ist. Die Rolle der Kreativität im Leben und die Werkzeuge, die sie möglich machen. Das ist etwas, das Besucher hier auf der Konferenz verstehen werden. Das wirkliche Thema hier ist die Bedeutung der Normen der Offenheit, nicht für die Gesellschaft, sondern für das Individuum. My talk, the rest of which will be in English, is comprised of four parts. I have an interest in net neutrality since 2003 or so, when we started to call it net neutrality. But as time has passed, I've become increasingly interested in not just the economic aspects, but the social, political, and more than anything, the freedom-based aspects of why we demand an open, non-discriminatory environment from carriers. So today I'm going to talk about the question of why we want the underlying freedom at all. Why it matters to be able to choose the content you reach or the tools that you use, how that informs who we become or what we are, and then to focus very carefully on this question of public versus private censorship. It is my belief that we, particularly in the West, are familiar with the problem of public censorship, but that we've only started to understand the problem of private censorship recently. We've only started to understand that the most important speech decisions today are being made by private entities rather than public. So let's begin with this question of why we're seeking freedom, why it matters, what the underlying foundation of the net neutrality issue are. You can start with a local character, a German, Professor Hegel, from the University of Berlin. And here's what Hegel said. He said it in German originally. A person must give to his freedom an external sphere in order that he reach the completeness implied in the idea. The idea or the sentiment in these words is that the importance of freedom of speech or of freedom of development is the opportunity to develop into a full person. The opportunity through the external sphere to make choices that might make you who you become. Now, Hegel is not the only person who said this. This is John Stuart Mill and his wife, both of whom wrote the book, Harriet Taylor, who wrote the book On Liberty. And if you read this book again, this is almost a Bible to libertarians. If you read this book again, you find very carefully this idea that the reason we want freedom is not just so you can choose one type of milk or a different type of cheese, but that through your choices, you can potentially become the person you were meant to be, that you can develop your character, that you can find a deeper sense of individuality. And it's not just an idea. When we talk about these ideas, I think we have to understand that an idea that's so 2010 or 21st century as net neutrality, the idea of this freedom of choice of information has its foundations in much older ideas, Eastern ideas from writers like Lao Tzu, Indian writers, Hindu theory. Many of these things are focused on this goal of self-development, self-actualization, pursued through freedom, freedom from all forces, not simply laws, but freedom from norms, freedom from internal pressures, freedom from everything. These all lead to this question of who you are. And, it's easy to sort of trivialize the role that bloggers or other internet people play. But at a deeper level, what the internet has made possible, what today's communications mediums have made possible, is to have more control over what information you're exposed to and what tools you use. And it comes down to this question, this Hegelian or this Aristotelian notion of trying to figure out that the point of life itself is to figure out just who you are. Now, let me explain how this relates to today's communications networks. Part of who we are, of course, is not really within our control. It's genetic and not something you can modify with a protocol, at least not yet. But the other aspects are things that are very carefully within our control. The most powerful aspect, I think, are two. First, the information that we receive coming towards us, how we interpret it, what our information environment looks like. This is obviously something that's going to change a lot depending on what kind of informational choices you make. You can expose yourself to information that makes you angry, that makes you happy, makes you sad, does whatever. But the fact is, that to an extent unprecedented in human history, we choose what sort of information is in our lives. The second is the aspect of what tools we, the second fundamental aspect, is the roles that tools play in our life. What humans do, what they become, who you are, you can understand very deeply as a function of the tools you use in your daily life. Those once axes as in that diagram. You could be a writer, you could be a photographer, you could be a soldier. More than anything, it's a tool and the choice of tool that plays a crucial role in the expression of the abstract free will, in the process of self-actualization and self-development. In our times, and this is why, it's important to be aware that the computer and the wireless phone and some of these tablets, things like this, these are our tools of our time. These are defining who we are. The freedoms we have on these platforms are not just important to geeks or to tools, but they define exactly what we will be, what we will become, in an individual sense and in a social sense. So here's Douglas Engelbart's first interface. He's a computer scientist from the 1960s. I'm not completely sure what happened to the thing on the left. But there you can see the mouse. I'm not really sure what that is. But you see there the first mouse, the first keyboard. First conceived of in 1950, first developed in 1968. This is the tool revolution that we've all lived with. The development of the personal computer, the move of power, of information processing, away from centralized entities and towards the individual. As part of the movement in the 1970s toward against centralized power, against against monopoly, towards power in the individual, towards the notion of small is beautiful. The computer, ideologically, is deeply linked to these ideas of freedom and personal choice. And today, the same fellow, a little bit older, still designing the tools that are defining who we are. Now, I want to talk about the issue of censorship. The idea of the control of information. I think everyone knows what censorship is. Everyone is familiar with the classic examples of censorship and the general idea that censorship is bad. In America, censorship is closely associated with this man, George III, the king. The reaction to his control over what Americans could receive as information was part of the reasons behind the First Amendment. But the idea of censorship has a much, much longer history, obviously, and is really fundamental in the course of human freedom. If you think right back to the beginning, if you think of the poisoning of Socrates, what was Socrates punished for? Speech. No one really liked Socrates because he kind of walked around and asked a lot of questions. If you ever read the Socratic dialogues, you realize he must have been kind of an annoying figure. But anyway, the great tragedy of antiquity, the two great tragedies, is an issue of censorship. He said things that were unpopular and therefore was put to death by self-poisoning. The other great example, censorship, the original example for Christians, is a punishment of dissent heresy within the Jewish faith by the crucifixion of Jesus Christ or Jesus. And it goes on, we're familiar with the censorship of information, the Reformation, the idea of dissent from a received doctrine by another German, Martin Luther, suppressed intensely by Pope Leo X, who excommunicated Martin Luther. And finally, another local example. Sorry to say, put it that way, but you have the example of censorship in the Second World War. These are all the examples of public censorship, which I suggest are our dominant way of thinking about this problem. But the truth is that we have seen a major change in the way power is allocated in society in the last century. The last thousands of years, the powerful entities that mattered were almost always emperors, kings, local warlords, in short, public figures. What we have seen, coming mostly from the United States, is the rise of private power that has come to equal public power. And with that, we've begun to see the rise of private gatekeepers whose power over speech rivals that of the most powerful public actors in history. So what I'm going to do, and the final thing we've seen is not only have we seen private power grow, but we live in an age where in the Western world, where in the world of private corporations, that speech is privately controlled. That the most important speech organizations are private entities. And so I want to talk about the history of American film censorship. What's particularly interesting about the history of American film censorship are several things. First of all, it's not a very well-known history unless you happen to be a historian. It's not known the way, you know, the stories of Socrates, stories of Jesus, the stories of Leo X. But what's also interesting, it is possibly, with some exceptions, the most intensive and effective part or history or example of censorship in the history of the United States. This man here is Daniel Lord. He was a Jesuit priest, and he devoted his life to the elimination of filth in the public sphere, particularly in the cinema. Daniel Lord had a very simple but very clear idea that the point of all media should be to reinforce received truth and never to challenge it. In his conception, the truth was known, was clear, and ought to be reinforced and never challenged. Now, Daniel Lord was an interesting essayist. He was an important figure. But he's important in particular because it is he who wrote the censorship code for American film. In the 1920s, he wrote this code, a code to govern the making and motion of talking pictures, the reason supporting it, and the resolution for uniform interpretation. Some of you may have heard of this. It's sort of well known as the rule that, or the book that required couples to sleep in separate beds. Let's take a look at this. Here is the absolute center of this code. There's three principles that were the key to this system of film censorship in the United States. Number one, no picture shall be produced that will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathy of the audience should never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. The second principle was that correct standards of life, subject only to the requirement of drama entertainment, shall be presented. Third, law, natural or human, shall not be ridiculed, nor shall sympathy be created for its violation. So what was interesting about these censorship rules? One thing is, you've maybe heard of the idea of the Hollywood ending. So these are the rules that suggested that when you see Hollywood movies, they have to have a happy ending. Here's the source of that kind of idea. Moreover, when you look carefully at the rules, they suggested, for example, that you could have a corrupt police officer, but the police system could never be corrupt. You could have a corrupt judge, but the legal system had to be proven in the end to be righteous. You could have a single misbehaving priest, but in the end the Catholic Church could never be directly questioned. And if you watch carefully films in America, you'll see how often, especially in mainstream film, and under the age of the code, these values are reinforced in subtle and not subtle ways. The code, not only to say that, was not only this general, but also had very specific ideas. For example, the code had very particular reasons for dancing, rules for dancing, similar to what you might see similar to the kind of rules the Americans have criticized in other countries. This is America in the 1930s. Dances suggesting or representing sexual actions or indecent passions are forbidden. Dances which emphasize indecent movements are to be regarded as obscene. And obscene things were all banned. This is an actress named Mae West. Some of you may know her, whose films, the code essentially ended her career. She was a similar character to Samantha on Sex and the City. She's the ones who said, "Is that a gun? Are you happy to see me?" This is her famous line. Anyway, she could no longer make films after the introduction of the enforcement of the code in 1934. It's another segment from the code, portraying the racial side of it. There was never to be portrayal of black and white people having sex. And it goes on and it goes on. So you might wonder, well, okay, it's one thing for Daniel Lord to have his code. But how exactly was this enforced? Was this something that people would just ignore, or is it something? Well, when they first wrote in the 20s, it wasn't paid much attention to. But eventually, and the key here is to understand that more than anything, it was industry structure that made possible what was America's most effective censorship system. In 1915, there were over 11,000 films made in the United States. This was a predecessor to the YouTube era. There was nearly 11 films, if I'm not mistaken, made every day in the United States. It was an extremely vibrant period. Now, you know, they weren't necessarily all good films. Some of them were like YouTube videos. People jumping around, falling out of trains. They weren't always the best movies, but there was a lot of movies covering every topic. What happened in the American film industry, and it's a lesson for the internet, was there was an enormous concentration and integration of all the industries. Until there were really only, there's only four here, but five major studios, fully integrated, which controlled everything. And this is what made possible the production code. This is what made possible censorship. Industrial integration. Daniel Lord in 1934, after the last Mae West film, called for a Catholic boycott of all motion pictures. No Catholic who was going to stay in good standing with the church was to attend a film, he suggested. And it resists to what the industry reacted, the threat of a boycott. And so because you had only four or five studios, eight total, five integrated studios, there was only five people you needed to get control of in order to enforce a censorship regime over American film. And after that, it was simple. No film that was not pre-approved by the Motion Picture Authority was allowed to be played. There's an interesting history here. Warner Brothers, for example. Oh, and let me say one thing. The man who was in charge of enforcing it all was this fellow, Joseph Breen. In a private letter, he bragged to his friends, "I am the one man who can cram decent ethics down the throats of the Jews." So he saw his role in enforcing the norms of a Catholic and Protestant majority over Jewish filmmakers who controlled most of the studios in Hollywood. He saw his role in very explicit terms in making sure the majority's ethics were used to control the minority. This is Joseph Breen. So what's interesting as a point of history is, for example, Warner Brothers, concerned about concentration camps in Germany in the 1930s, began doing a film, or planned to do a film, exposing the early concentration camps. Joseph Breen refused permission to have the film be made, and so it was never made. In this system, every single film that was to be made was to be submitted for pre-approval. And this is the little room where they would read a script and decide whether or not it could be made, what changes had to be made, and so forth. Now, the reason I discuss this example, which is, I think, one of the more powerful examples of private censorship in American history, not the only example, is to suggest that it holds extremely important lessons for our times in the internet. There have been, over the course of history, many new media which arise, are invented, go through a flourishing where a time where there are thousands of voices, hundreds of outlets, where it seems impossible to imagine it could ever be a controlled or censored regime. People thought that way about film in the 1910s. They felt that way about radio in America in the 1920s. They felt that way about the telephone in the 1910s, turn of the century. Every single media goes through its period of openness, of idealism, of unrestrained content. But it is the rise of private power, or sometimes public power, that can spell the end of that era. And it is against that that you must always be vigilant. And it is this particular danger that I think net neutrality is reacting to. So now I'm going to come to the part of the talk where I discuss network neutrality norms. What I want to suggest to you is that while net neutrality, that you've probably heard the debate on both sides, should networks be less discriminatory, should networks be non-discriminatory, there's some points in net neutrality where reasonable people could disagree. The questions of speeding up, you know, particular types of content, whether you should allow adjustments for video or voice versus data. These are points over which reasonable minds may disagree. But there's a much deeper side to net neutrality, and that's where it's understood as a general principle of freedom, a general principle of openness, extended into the modern age. At the core of the net neutrality principle is the old idea of non-discrimination. The old idea The English idea of common carriage, which you find in taxis, which you find on ferries, which you find on bridges, which you find on every crucial infrastructure in most civilized countries. The idea that if you are an essential part of the economy, it's crucial that that part of the economy operate without discrimination. And what I'm suggesting today is not simply for economic reasons, innovation reasons, which I don't deny are important, but what we are dealing with is speech. And so it is rules like net neutrality rules, and we can see this already happening in America, that net neutrality is becoming as important to free speech as the First Amendment. The open internet's issues, I mean, you can call net neutrality, you can call it what you want, but the rules that control private speech gatekeepers are becoming the speech code of America and may eventually become the speech rules for the world. What are these rules looking like? Well, there's lots of legislation. Now, this is what I wanted to say. We also live, I want to suggest, in America in particular, in America, competition is the exception, monopoly is the rule. We've lived in 20 years of robust competition, but the truth is, for most of American communications history, it has been controlled by monopolies. I would not be surprised if we see the reemergence of duopolies or monopolies in every American communications industry over the next 10 years. There's every reason to suggest the advantages of economies of scale, the desire for power by the men who run powerful companies, the advantages of an integrated business. America's monopolies in the operating system business, monopolies in the search engine business. I would not be surprised that we see a reemergence of monopoly in most areas of communication businesses as well. Internet, comprised of monopolies or duopolies, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, the largest companies. And that's why these rules become so important, because when you have that kind of market power, the temptation for private censorship becomes intense. And what I want to point out again, using the example of the Catholic Church, it's not these people you have to be worried about. They don't care. These companies generally are interested in making money, which is reasonable for a company. What you need to be worried about are the entities who care about speech are in a position to control these characters. What we learned in the 1930s, it wasn't that the studios wanted to censor. They didn't. They just wanted to make films. But it's parties who care, who want to censor, who are able to intimidate concentrated powers. They're the ones you need to be careful about. And so in our age, the question is, for example, whether the government might be able to, as they already did, say, you know, listen, we need to know a little bit about some Americans. We need to intercept all internet traffic and take a look at it. Whether the government or whether church groups or other groups say, you know, we need to have certain websites blocked all over the United States because they're dangerous to children or dangerous to received wisdom. It is, again, not the carriers who matter, but the people who are able to put pressure on the carriers. And when there's only two or three choices, it's very easy to swing everything towards one direction. So what are the rules that have sort of come up? Well, they're not very complicated. I mean, there's a lot of complicated ways of presenting it, but as I've seen it, most of it is boiled down to three essential points. And here we're not talking at the level of law, but we're talking at the level of norms, ethics, rules for society. Thou shalt not block, thou shalt not discriminate unfairly, and thou shalt let users use the tools of their choice. These are principles which are not hard to understand. There's only three of them. And I want to suggest they have, to some degree, already become the governing ethos of companies that do business on the internet. A company like Comcast, the American cable company, 2 years ago began blocking BitTorrent. They never said they exactly had a right to block BitTorrent. They didn't say they were right to do it. They just said we weren't actually doing it. In the human rights world, sometimes you'll see that countries, they don't, well, with some exceptions, they don't say that torture is right. They deny that they're doing it. And that's where I believe some of the norms of openness have gotten. And that's what I believe is the most important thing. Laws and regulations come and go. I don't deny they're important. I'm a professor of law, and I tend to think these things matter a little bit. But much more important is the underlying values that are subscribed to by people in government, of course, but also by the industry itself. But most important of all, people like you, the general public. Because the firms, they don't really care about these issues in any kind of ideological sense. But they do care about public reaction to the things they do. And so I think, and I charge you as the public here in Germany, to hold every company to these rules. There's reasonable debate around them. As I said, there's such a thing as reasonable discrimination, fair discrimination. It's like cholesterol, there's good and bad forms. But the very essence of the rules are extremely important, because I predict that in the coming years, the pressure to censor the internet will become intense. This is a quote from John Stuart Mill. I want to remind you again and come back to the beginning and say why I think these rules are important. I think they're important because they are fundamentally rules about choice, rules that are designed to let people do what they can to cultivate their own personality, their own individuality. As I said earlier, to find out, in some sense, who they are. And that requires the ability to be exposed to points of view, to choose among them, to choose the tools that you use. That freedom, well, it may seem kind of, you know, to someone who has a very fancy computer and so forth, may seem safe, but in very subtle ways it can be eroded. And not just by laws or technical decisions, but just by the disapproval, the sort of society we live in. And so what net neutrality, to my mind, is linked to, despite its modern name and its link to the internet and computers, is these fundamental questions of freedom, self-actualization, self-development, freedom of speech. That's all I have, and so I'd be pleased to now take any questions anyone might have. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. You said in your second rule, thou shalt not discriminate unfairly.
Yeah.
But then actually the whole debate boils down to who decides what is fair and under which criteria and so on. So yeah. Could you say a bit more on that?
Yeah, it's a good point. When I was writing that, I was like, someone's going to ask me, which is a fair question, what does unfairly mean? And I thought, well, or who decides what's fair or what's unfair? The reason I put that word in there is because, you know, I'm not an absolutist about discrimination. in the carriage of information. It's an impossible position to take, that you should never. Anyone who runs a network understands there's management decisions and so forth. As I've understood it, I don't know if there's a better alternative. I guess there's two ideas. The idea I favor, and one that began in the Comcast hearings back in the United States, the idea was to see if you could see the weight of internet expert opinion make this decision. So when Kevin Martin, the chair of the FCC at the time, the American regulator, was trying to figure out whether Comcast was being reasonable in its actions towards BitTorrent, he called David Reed, he called David Clark, he called in sort of the internet gurus and called other people and said, you know, do you think this is a reasonable way of doing business? And their opinion was that it was not, because it was done secretly, because they lied about what they were doing, and because it was a unilateral action. And so I think if you take testimony from people who are serious about networks, you can discover relatively easily whether the discrimination in question is done in good faith, legitimate motives, or whether it's something designed to gain a short-term advantage, or even most dangerously or clearly either censor on the basis of content or try to gain a business advantage. So that's roughly how I think it should be done. In other words, I think fairly is on the weight of expert opinion. Thanks.
You brought up, and I was very pleased to hear it, the parallel to what we call in the U.S. common carrier law.
Yeah.
But that hasn't gotten much traction in the net neutrality debate, that one should be offered the opportunity, or indeed that ISPs should be compelled in the way that an airline or a bus company is. If they want a license to transport people, they can only be licensed if they agree to operate as a common carrier.
Right.
But there isn't even an option to get service from an ISP that agrees to operate as a common carrier of packets.
Right.
Should a carrier that offers internet access be required to offer as an option a service that operates as a common carrier of packets? And should they, going further, be licensed only if they operate as a common carrier of packets?
Right. I'll answer that question very straightforwardly. I don't think at a fundamental level there's any real difference between the conception of net neutrality and common carriage. I think they are basically the same idea. And you know, it's net neutrality has a nice ring to it. So does common carriage, actually. The difference is that common carriage, it's going to be a little regulatorily complex, but common carriage took on a lot of baggage. It began associated with very intrusive regulation of prices, government specification of network design. It got a very complicated, intrusive regime. But that's not essential to the nature, and monopoly premised. That's not essential to the nature of common carriage, in my mind. If you look at the roots of common carriage, going back to 15th century, very simple principle. It just simply says, you must serve every customer who comes to you, you must charge them the same prices, deliver the same services, and post your rates and not charge unreasonable rates. My view of this may be beyond the scope of this talk, but my view of communications regulation is you only need one rule, and that's really a non-discrimination rule. And that is the exact heart of common carriage. So, yes, there is a lot of baggage attached to common carriage at this point, and so it's made it, in Washington, D.C., it's a word that's difficult to talk about. But the truth is, when you boil it down, you go back to the ancient principles, people looked, go give it a biblical example. The whole idea of the innkeeper being a common carrier, it's pretty obvious where that idea came from. It's from the problem of people showing up in the middle of the night, no place to go, being denied service because they're of a certain race, or just the innkeeper doesn't like them, and so they have to go stay in a stable somewhere. This idea that private actors have an enormous amount of power over you when they offer an essential service is common carriage. And the internet is very obviously our common medium today. You know, it seems so clear that there's no alternative. Everyone here would, if you took this conference and cut off the internet for the people here, you'd probably die after a week. My prediction. I don't know you all that well, but I would predict. It's very clear that it's like electricity or something, that it's the utility of our time. So there's no question, really, when you get down to it. But you know, in Washington, it's a loaded word, which is why it's been avoided. Yeah.
Hey, Tim. So you mentioned that we shouldn't worry all that much about AT&T and Verizon and Comcast. They just want to make money.
Yeah.
We should worry about the lords of our day. But when you put up the picture of George...
Why don't you introduce yourself, by the way?
I'm Marvin Amore. I was a lawyer for Free Press, and I was involved in the Comcast case.
You brought the Comcast cases to be more specific. Yeah. But go ahead, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
With help. But when you showed a picture of George III, that reminded me of the Stamp Act in the U.S. that helped lead to the Revolution, where King George raised the taxes on print for newspapers, for legal documents, and it was essentially a tax on knowledge and speech. And raising the costs of the tools of communication also has a huge effect on who can speak to whom and how.
That's true.
And so to the extent that the phone and cable companies are raising the prices of people being able to speak, and maybe in discriminatory ways, it still has an effect on speech that I think you overlooked when you said we shouldn't worry too much about that.
Yeah, that's true. The price of speech determines how much of it there is. You know, and I was saying in the 1910s, it was very easy to make a movie. There's thousands of movies made, all kinds of topics. 1920s, it was very easy to open a radio station, so everyone opened radio stations. You know, today, to open a radio station or make a movie is a multi-million dollar operation. And so less people speak. So I think that point's exactly right. I guess what I was trying to suggest is that, and I'll repeat it, is that when we talk about the worst forms of censorship, the most dangerous forms, they're often not from commercial entities, but again, from people who have an interest in controlling speech. And commercial entities have no, you know, they have some reasons to resist, but they may not be adequate safeguards. I mean, even Google, which is the most, you know, among the companies that considers itself committed to free speech norms, nonetheless was willing to go into China, at least for a while, and subject itself to a Chinese speech code.
I'm Stefan from the internet, and I'd like to elaborate a little bit more on Marvin's question. I think that it's not only about censorship, and we shouldn't be only afraid about the governments or whatever who's controlling these ISPs, but because the ISPs themselves are also have incentives to censor. This is triple play, quadruple play, where they are discriminating their own content. Yeah. And this is also censorship, and we should be afraid of those guys as well.
Yeah, that's a good, I think it's a good point. To my mind, when you see the most particularized dangers, or when you see, this is the real problem of vertical integration. Sorry? Yeah, the greatest interest in censorship come when you have a competing product. And so when a company, I view as fundamental. I have a new book coming out in November. It's called The Master Switch. And the thesis of that book, basically, this is a long way of answering your question. Number one is that we've seen all these problems before, and we will always see the same problems. And number two, the greatest dangers come when you have the same people controlling transmission and content. We need a wall, a line, a separation principle that separates transmission from content, almost like a separation of church and state. And so I think the dangers of private censorship from the big companies themselves come most particularly when they've become interested in content themselves. And this is a danger of something like, in America, the Comcast-NBC merger. You have an extremely powerful, one of America's most powerful movers of information, owning some of America's most important information. The conflict of interest is obvious.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I wanted to ask about the strange dichotomy between the fact that the internet is a global network that's kind of uncontrollable, whereas creative freedom is primarily determined by national sovereignty. So it's the law within a country or the law within the European Union. Look at where I'm from, the digital economy bill just went through. That impacts British creative freedom hugely. So that's a kind of strange dichotomy. You've got people whose creative freedom is unlimited to a certain extent on the internet, and then you've got the national law, which will say what you can actually do. So how do we go about, should there be, I don't know about international law in terms of overriding national law, but that seems to be where the censorship thing gets a bit odd.
Well, that's an interesting question. It was kind of the subject of my first book, Who Controls the Internet? I think the truth is that that countries have and will take different approaches to these problems. They maintain their national authority, as you suggested. And that's why what matters more than anything else is the existence of norms in these areas. I mean, we're having this discussion here. Here we are in Germany talking about net neutrality, which, you know, 5 years ago was a word that no one had heard of, or a phrase no one had heard of. Yesterday, not 2 days ago, I was in Paris talking about the same issue. Thanks. And so, you know, or we could talk about open internet, or we could talk about whatever. The point is, more important really than international law is international norms. The spread of a certain set of ethics, you know, these three principles I talked about, if they are seen as to be sort of the right or the accepted principles, and that can sometimes affect or coordinate the way different nations deal with the same problems. But not a full answer. I can talk to you more later if you like, but I think we have time for one or two more questions.
Okay. So my question is about the the dynamics that network neutrality can bring to creative freedom. And so there is one dynamic against creative freedom, if I understand well, that is censorship that is easier with integrated and centralized networks with ISPs, and especially when the market of ISPs is considered just monopolist. So the solution is network neutrality as a rule, but my question is on how do the rules can have an effect on not only the ISPs, but also on services, because the control can come from networks, but also from services on the network.
Right.
So is network neutrality enough for that, or do we have to go beyond?
Yeah. You know, usually, I think it's a good question, and typically we've talked about net neutrality as being important for carriers, for people who move information. They have the most potential power. But you have services which have reached the level of infrastructure. Our friends at Google are the most important examples. And I can tell you that the moment Google begins to discriminate in its searches is the moment I say Google, and Google needs to be answered, for example, needs to be answerable for that, potentially even be regulated. And so I agree, there are services that can reach the same kind of essential nature that carriage can. So it's not a principle that's only centered on network carriers. And it's the same thing with tools. I mean, when we see tools come out, you know, there may be some latitude to have different types of tools, but it's important that at some level it be available at least to have open tools. Yeah.
That's the final question. I think I'm out of time.
I have two questions, actually.
Okay.
The first one is, to what extent is net neutrality for you synonymous for anti-censorship? And the second one is one you already brought up. Isn't net neutrality like this big delusion because already the search algorithm of Google does not allow for net neutrality completely? You know, we use it every day,
right,
and it gives us like a rant. Like you said, you shall not undiscriminate fairly.
Right.
And the algorithm itself makes a discrimination,
right,
not necessarily
right,
like a involuntary
right,
one, but it is
right,
a discrimination nonetheless.
It's a good point. I mean, I said, I don't think net neutrality is only about censorship. I want to say it's deepest, most fundamental foundation is as a guard against private censorship. It has a lot of different meanings. It's important for economic and cultural reasons. But at its very base, the most important thing about it is the guard against censorship. We can see this by seeing the one country that absolutely rejects net neutrality. There's one nation in the world that has no interest in net neutrality whatsoever, and that's China. If China had a net neutrality rule, it could not support the system it has. And what's interesting about China is that all of the censorship is done by private parties, not by the government. It is a system of private censorship which rivals or exceeds anything we've ever seen before, all sort of at the suggestion of government as opposed to at the... So that is the most important impact, and that's its deepest ideological foundations, which is what I was trying to build off. The second question is whether, you know, a company, there will be some necessary discrimination to have good services. I absolutely agree. And that's why I said, like cholesterol, there's good and bad discrimination. You know, a search engine has to make a choice. When you type in mushroom or cheese or bicycle, something has to be first. And the question is whether that's done in a good-natured, good-faith kind of way, or whether it's done with a motive. And we must, I think, constantly on guard, constantly be aware of the motives behind those who are giving us our information. That is what, or really our only chance of freedom, is to understand, again, the motives of those who are creating and constructing our information environment. All right, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Gleich ansagen, sie ist fertig. Ich brauche keine Präsentation.
Alles klar. Es geht